We live in a nice part of the world, but is it truly paradise? When you use that term, people tend to think of things like white sandy beaches and palm trees and tropical breezes. That's what our next guest thought of when he thought of paradise. Alex Shashinoff is the author of a book on his own departure from quote-unquote civilization in search of a piece of paradise in the Pacific. The book is called The Beginner's Guide to Paradise. Subtitled, I take a breath, 9 Steps to Giving Up Everything So You Too Can Move to a Pacific Island, Wear a Loincloth, Read 100 Books, Build a Bungalow, Diaper a Baby Monkey, and Maybe, Just Maybe, Fall in Love. With an asterisk, individual results may vary, baby monkey not included. Alex Shashinoff describes himself as a writer-like person. His work has appeared on Marketplace on NPR and National Geographic Adventure, Slate.com, and other media outlets. His other major claim to fame is starting and running an internet company called E the People, which was a nonpartisan predecessor to MoveOn.org. He's been busy. Alex Shashinoff, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeff.
So how hard were you working in those internet startup days?
Well, to me, it felt pretty hard. I was working maybe 60-hour weeks and for about 5 years without a vacation, so I felt like I had maybe earned a little time away.
Did you feel like you were making progress? I mean, you were getting some recognition, I understand.
Yeah, well, yeah, per employee, we did get a lot of attention. We had a little office in Soho in New York and had a ping pong table and, you know, classic internet startup kind of thing. And it was good hard work, and but after a while I realized that, you know, maybe I didn't want to spend the rest of my life doing it.
Tell us about showing up on a list of influential people in technology in New York.
Oh yeah, that's right. I was running this little internet company, and this tiny magazine ranked me 96th out of the 100 most influential people in tech in the city. It was early days, was not a huge achievement, but the day that came out, I realized I had two choices. I could spend the rest of my life working my way up the list, or I could cancel my subscription. And so, you know, it was a pretty easy choice.
Well, give us a sense of the rest of it. I mean, outside of work, if there was much outside of work. I mean, it sounds like a dream to a lot of youngish people in New York City, the tech biz, living in Greenwich Village. Outside of work, what was life like?
Well, you know, I did have a pretty good life. You know, I had a girlfriend, this nice apartment, or pretty nice apartment, and a job living in the city. But, you know, at the time it wasn't turn your life upside down kind of bad, but in 30 years I thought it might be, and by that time I was worried it was going to be too late. So I felt like I either had to make a break for it then or maybe never. So I one night, this is embarrassing, but I Googled really nice Pacific Island. And it turns out that wasn't nearly specific enough. There are 29,000 islands in the Pacific. But the one that came up first was this island called the Yap. And all I knew about it was that it was pretty traditional. The women were topless and people still wore loincloths. And, well, what I didn't know was that they didn't have any beaches and they had a growing leprosy problem. But I would find that out later.
All right, we'll get to that later. But so back to New York, you actually got a bit of a warning from your own body, it sounds like, that maybe it was time to do something different.
Yeah, that's right. About 3 in the morning one night, I woke up with some chest pain. And I was 28. I was too young to be waking up in the middle of the night with chest pain. And so I didn't know what was happening, so I got in the shower. And in the shower, I fainted. And my girlfriend called an ambulance, and I get to the hospital. And at the hospital, there was a crew from the Discovery Channel filming a reality TV show. They asked me to sign all these forms, and I thought, oh, my God, either I, like, die alone in this hospital or I die on television. I don't know which is better. But I declined to sign the forms. And it turned out it was just a panic attack, but it did make me realize that that maybe I needed a change.
You talked about a couple of other potential options here, you know, the kinds of options that people do tend to think about when they're trying to exchange their lives for something else. You didn't want to open a bar or a bed and breakfast in Vermont, you point out. Why not?
Well, you know, in part because I had actually worked at bed and breakfast in Southern Oregon one summer as a kid. I worked in Fort Klamath at a little lodge. And,
see, another region.
I remember and I remember my address was... was Alex Shashinoff, the Big Red House, Fort Klamath, Oregon. But that summer made me realize I didn't really have the heart for hospitality. I didn't have it in me. And lacking imagination, I decided just to see if I could make that screensaver real and find capital P paradise.
So, okay, so no bar, no bed and breakfast in Vermont. So you knew what you were leaving behind. Did you have much of a conception of what you wanted ahead of you other than this idea of being surrounded by a paradisical kind of place?
Right. You know, I had this idea, and it was probably misguided, but it was that you can't back into an ideal life. It's something that you had to create from scratch. And so if you don't aim big, then you're not going to back into it. So I was pushed as much as I was pulled. I was pushed out of my life in New York and then pulled to this idea of creating a life from scratch that was more meaningful. That was the hope. I also brought along the 100 books I was most embarrassed not to have read in college, and I thought those might provide some guidance so I could learn from the experience of others rather than just my own experience.
100 books then, huh? Wow. So how'd you work on that list?
Well, I went around and asked all the people I knew, if you could send me to the Pacific with just one book, what would it be? My mother's suggestion was maybe a little more extreme than most. She gave me Into the Wild, about the guy who heads into the wilderness and dies.
Oh, right. She was trying to send you a message, I suspect.
Yeah, no, that's right. She was certain I was going to wake up in, a big bowl of somebody else's soup or something. But I also brought a lot of the classics, War and Peace and Moby Dick and all these books I felt I should have read.
All right, so a list of 100 books to take with them. We'll find out how many of them he actually took and a lot more about Alex Sheshinov's adventure. A Beginner's Guide to Paradise is his book. We'll give the full subtitle on the other side of a break because it takes so long to read. You can join Alex on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about his experiences in the South Pacific and things you might want to relate about your own experiences. 800-838-3760 by phone, jx@jeffnet by email. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Alex Sheshinov and you in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the writer Alex Sheshinov, or as he describes himself, a writer-like person with work in NPR and Slate.com and other media outlets. He's written a book about his desire to get away from it all in New York City, escape the rat race, and move to a deserted tropical island. It wasn't entirely deserted. His book about this is called The Beginner's Guide to Paradise, 9 Steps to Giving Up Everything So You Too Can Move to a Pacific Island, Wear a Loincloth, Read 100 Books, Build a Bungalow, Diaper a Baby Monkey, and Maybe, Just Maybe, Fall in Love, which might set the record for one of the longest subtitles in the world, and it comes with an asterisk. Individual results may vary, baby monkey not included. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Alex will guess that 99% of the people who would like to follow you in this quest probably can't afford to. How did you?
Well, it turns out that living in the South Pacific is much cheaper than vacationing there, and there's not much to buy on an island with no stoplights. In my case, I got lucky. I left during the real estate boom in New York and was able to sublet my apartment and office for more than I was paying. In effect, someone was working crazy long hours in New York so I could read a bunch of books in the South Pacific. I found it ironic. My subletter maybe less so.
Probably. So you mentioned typing really nice Pacific Island into a search engine, which was the more focused term. You had typed just Pacific Island in the first time and got a gigantic number of listings. Tell us a bit about the island of Yap and what appealed to you about it.
Well, I didn't
on the
know
internet
much
at first.
About it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. I didn't know much about it, but when I showed up, it was pretty different from what I was expecting. The sort of screensaver version of paradise was not what I initially found. It has very dusty streets, dogs asleep in the middle of the road, a lot of flies, and people were a little wary of this sort of new guy who comes with a bunch of books and doesn't know anybody. That, they just didn't really have a way to understand that idea. And so it took some adjusting.
Did you bring all 100 books with you?
Well, you know, at first it turns out that also that you can't carry 100 books. At least I couldn't in my little like flight attendant bag, and so I brought 20, and then had my mother ship me the rest.
You hadn't gotten into e-books by that time, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So, without using up the next 20 minutes on directions, where is the island of Yap? And what's it part of?
I'll try to do it in 19.
All right, fair enough.
No, it's as far to the left in the Pacific as you can get before like getting to Asia. So to get there, for example, you fly to Honolulu and then 7 hours to Guam and then 2 hours south from Guam to Yap. They only have one flight a week, and so it's far western Pacific.
Was that part of the appeal to you, that you were going to places where you couldn't get on or off that often, that you'd have to deal with it?
Yeah, no, that absolutely was. When I got to Yap, it did even occur to me, even though it was difficult to get to, that maybe I didn't really want to live in a place that I could fly away from the moment things got rough. So as a result, I ended up finding my way onto a freighter called the Micro Spirit. It wasn't so much, threatened by rust as held together by it. And so the freighter does a circuit to the outer islands of Yap. And so I sort of got on this ferry. I had to get permission from the Council of Chiefs, and they told me to bring cigarettes as gifts. So I brought a lot of cigarettes and started going to some of these outer islands. And on each one, I had about an hour to decide if I wanted to potentially stay there for weeks or potentially for the rest of my life.
So really, you were getting into this little launch, going ashore and seeing if you liked it enough or thought you did in the few minutes you were there to want to stick around for a while?
Yeah, it was incredibly awkward, as you can imagine. It occurred to me that, if somebody had shown up to my apartment in New York from Yap and said, "I had this vision of paradise and it looks just like your apartment, can I stay?" What would I have said? but they didn't get a lot of visitors, and they were gracious, and eventually I did find an island that I wanted to stay on, and that would have me. It was called Pig. They have islands out there that have more than three letters in their name, but the first two did only have three.
Yap and Pig. Okay. Is Pig the word in English, or is it from the local language?
Yeah, it is the word. It's both. That's how they say pig, and that's how they we say pig.
That seems fortunate then. Well, are there any pigs on Pig Island?
There actually wasn't. That was one of my first questions. But there's an island across on the other side of the atoll that did have a pig.
So what was it that appealed to you about Pig Island in the, sounds like 5 or 10 minutes you got to decide if this was the place you wanted to spend the next few months?
You know, when I first showed up on the island, it just had a different feeling than the other ones I had visited. That they all the houses are made out of thatch on all those islands, but they had this one meeting hut that where all the chiefs were gathered, and there are only 40 people on the island, so a lot of people, a lot of people got to be chief. But the chiefs had all these kids who were climbing on top of them and sort of wrestling with them, and they were the grown-ups were laughing about it, and it. Not to sound cliche, but it really did seem, at least superficially, like exactly the kind of place I was looking for.
So it doesn't sound like there's going to be a Holiday Inn on a place like Pig Island. So where did you find accommodations?
So they have a problem with, as you might imagine, with population loss. And as one of the chiefs described to me, it's kind of this perfect sort of valve for anybody who's not content on the island can leave, but as a result, a lot of people left, and so there were some. There was a thatch hut that was not being used that they let me stay in.
Alex Sheshinoff is our guest. His book is A Beginner's Guide to Paradise, and you can join a discussion here on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Let me come back a few steps because it's in chapter 4 in the book that you get to the point of telling loved ones. How'd that go over?
Well, not as well as I had hoped. The reactions tend to fall into one of like three different categories. One was, "Oh my God, I want to do that too. Tell me how it goes." And then the other third were, didn't really have a way to understand and were just kind of confused and wish me luck. And then the other third were more like my mom, who thought I was going to wake up in someone's soup, as I said. So, when I was doing it, there was no script to follow. So people didn't really have a way to understand, and nor did I even at the beginning, what I was doing. But I did have this conviction that that I needed a change, and I needed a dramatic one.
So, speaking of your mom, you mentioned that that the Pacific Island ideal is something like the opposite of your home growing up. How so?
Oh, yeah, I do mention my mother a little bit, but for the record, this is not a memoir about my mom.
Okay.
My relationship with her. She's an interesting lady, and she does appear on occasion. But she and my dad started a consulting business for community banks in the 70s, and worked incredibly hard. And my dad was traveling on the road 200 days a year. He once said to me that he thought he had a pretty good chance of dying in the Atlanta Hartsfield Airport. And I saw that example, and they really enjoyed having their own business, but it also didn't seem like necessarily the path that I wanted to follow. And fortunately, I had their firsthand example to see how that plays out.
So you packed up your own life and decided not to work long hours in New York City anymore. And then the pathway you mentioned through Honolulu and Guam on the way to Yap in the first place, but you left through Newark Airport. And why do you say it's always a good idea to leave the country through Newark Airport?
Well, I don't know. Have you been to the Newark Airport?
I have, but not for a very long time.
Okay, well,
there's a lot of northern New Jersey next to it.
Yeah, there is a lot of northern New Jersey in northern New Jersey. On the way to the airport, there's a state penitentiary and a Budweiser factory, and it did occur to me that it is a good idea if you're ever doing something really different that maybe you should always leave from Newark Airport. It will convince you that maybe you're making the right choice.
You're not leaving anything really romantic and pretty behind. That is for sure. This was all step one in your book, I should point out, which is in nine steps. The nine steps to giving you everything so you too can move to a Pacific island, wear a loincloth, read 100 books, build a bungalow, diaper a baby monkey, and maybe fall in love. The subtitle of the book. So nine steps. This was make some choices. Why write this in the manner you did as something like a travel guide?
Well, when I didn't set out to write a book when I left. There are a lot of people who will wear blue for a year and write a book about how it changed their life or something. It was this really sort of organic experience. But when I did get back, a lot of people said, "Oh, how did it go? What happened? And how do I do that too?" I didn't want to write a self-help book or a guidebook. I'm a storyteller, so I wanted to put it in story form, but in a way that was more accessible maybe than just a straight out typical memoir. You know, I should say, though, it is a memoir. It's got a lot of jokes. You know, I'm not like John Milton, who said he wrote Paradise Lost to justify the ways of God to man. You know, in my book, there's a lot of sugar to help a little bit of medicine go down.
Right. A lot of sugar in there as well. Yes, absolutely. So I want to get a little further into the description of what life is like in that part of the world. And you do point out that Yap is just ever so slightly closer to the equator than New York City. So, how did the environment hit you when you first got there?
Yeah, it's hot, and I know like complaining about the weather is like one of the least interesting things. But that part of the Pacific has some of the most hot and humid weather, and consistently hot and humid weather of any place in the world. It is hot day and night year round because it is so close to the equator, and so you know everything sticks to everything else. It's just the place is rust, and you could feel the sweat on your back just by like walking outside for about 10 seconds. It was extremely hot, and also what struck me when I first got there was that on the app they use stone money, which are these giant discs made out of rock that's quarried and put on canoes and another island and brought to Yap. They're 12 feet high and they weigh 2,000 pounds. And, you know, sometimes you go to another culture and it's fun to see how people do things differently and how they do things better. But 2,000-pound money is not better. It's worse.
Not pocket change. No, and people might not have believed it if you hadn't put pictures in the book, so appreciate that, too. So money, essentially, when it weighs that much and is that size, that's essentially like your bank account, visible for all to see?
Yeah, that's right. And it's too heavy to move, so people just remember who owns what.
How many people live on Yap? I haven't asked that yet.
Yeah, there are about 2,000 people, and maybe about as many stray dogs. And it's a very quiet, peaceful place.
So, what routine did you settle into in your early days there?
Well, early on, I was just reading all day, every day, and in this little motel room. And then I quickly found that I could not read all day. I was going crazy. So I made it a point to have one human interaction a day that was non-transactional. So not me like buying something, but me actually like talking to people. And I found that the best place to meet people was at the laundromat. And so the longer I was there, the more laundry I did. it turns out like washing underwear like 7 days, seven times a day is good for the soul, but maybe not the undies.
Alex Sheshinoff's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is A Beginner's Guide to Paradise. It's about his departure from New York City and working 60 hours a week for years without a vacation on an internet startup. And seeking an island in the South Pacific, and he ultimately found one through a little bit of trading up, as it turns out. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Jamie in Medford is on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Alex.
Morning, Jeffrey. Good morning, Alex.
Hi.
Good morning.
Alex, these questions, don't take them too seriously. They're kind of tongue-in-cheek, but first of all, I'd like to ask, well, first let's make a comment. I bet your publisher was miffed because after they finished printing the title, they didn't have any room for the cover art that they put on the books. question, slightly serious, is that there was this program way back a ways. I don't know whether they have it anymore on public radio. It was called Desert Island Discs. And the premise was that they interviewed somebody and asked them what kind of music they would want to play if they were stuck on a desert island. Now, Alex, my question to you is, if you were musically inclined, what's your taste in music? And if you turned it up too loud, would it upset the natives? And I'll take the answer off the air, Jeffrey.
All right. Thanks for that, Jamie.
Well, thanks for the questions, Jamie. Regarding the subtitle, it is really long. And it's also embarrassing when I'm at a party and someone asks me the name of my book, and I have to look it up.
Because you can't remember all of it, right?
But they were good sports about it. Desert Island Disc, yeah, I have heard about that program, and what a great premise. I think it's in England, is it not? Anyways, what album would I have? You know, if you only had one album, gosh, that would be tough. But I am a big fan of Radiohead, and probably Kid A. It's a little more interesting, maybe longer term. You know, it happened that when I was on one of those islands, when I was on Pig, they had solar panels and a DVD player, and they had just one video. And the video was, what was it called? It was called Gas Attack Training Made Simple.
Was it really?
Somebody had it. Yeah, it was really a training video, and it was like guys like running into this little shack, and then that was filled with smoke, and then running out, and they coughed.
Wow.
And once a week, they would gather around the television and watch this 20-minute-long creepy video. My heart still goes out to them.
And so we asked about 2,000 people on Yap Island, who said, how many people on Pig?
About 40.
Really? And how big an island?
It was maybe about a 10-minute walk around. There was another island out there called Llama Trek, which I did not stay on, but it was maybe 100 people, and they had two villages, one in the north and one in the south, and the villages, they hated each other, and they spoke slightly different languages, and they used to, like, attack each other years ago, and then they finally realized that they were, like, destroying their island and each other, and so they changed the rules that they would just like kidnap people and then hold them hostage, and then they would trade hostages back every once in a while anyways, people would find a way to sort of complexify life almost everywhere.
So by the time you got to Pig Island, it had been there for a little bit, and this sounds a little more paradise-like than Yap, there's a couple of ways you could take the image of being on an island in the South Pacific. One is the guy who looks like he's been shipwrecked there, and all the joke cartoons in the New Yorker that have appeared over the years along that vein. And then there's the whole paradise view with you can kind of hear the sound of the steel guitar in your head and all that sort of thing, and the ukulele. So I mean, did you think you were going to end up in one extreme or the other and get a pretty good mixture or end up with all the paradise part?
You know, I didn't really know. I was curious to find out if you set out to find sort of paradise out there. Did it still exist? The sort of the Gauguin one with the smiling tigers,
right,
and the big flowers, and was it still possible to find that? I didn't know, and I didn't know how it would obviously change me or not change me when I got there. You know, when I went out, I had this idea of taking away the things that I really valued, like friends and electricity, and see which one I miss most, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But what I ended up missing most ended up being chairs. People in Pig, they don't sit on chairs. They sit on coconuts, or they lie down, and I really wanted a chair after a while.
We'll talk about some of the other creature comforts that you had to leave behind in New York. Alex Sheshinoff is our guest on The Exchange. His book is A Beginner's Guide to Paradise, and yes, it's got a very long subtitle. We'll come back and get more of the subtitle and more from Alex about his journey when we return to the Jefferson Exchange with Alex and your phone calls in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking today with Alex Sheshinoff, a guy who did what a lot of people would like to do and make an escape for paradise. He got out of the rat race in New York City and working too hard for his internet startup and left it all behind and went to a small island it's actually the Western Pacific, not the South Pacific, I suppose. The book is called The Beginner's Guide to Paradise. It's subtitled 9 Steps to Giving Up Everything So You Too Can Move to a Pacific Island, Wear a Loincloth, Read 100 Books, Build a Bungalow, Diaper a Baby Monkey, and Maybe, Just Maybe, Fall in Love. Asterisk tells us individual results may vary, baby monkey not included. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk to Alex about his interesting new life, his adopted life there in the West Pacific, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we were talking about the kinds of music you would have liked to have brought. You brought like 20 books. It sounds like enough clothing to go to the laundromat on a regular basis. But what else did you take with you?
Well, on the outer island of Yap, I was told to bring gifts, and so I brought cigarettes, and that was about it. Cigarettes, T-shirts, and books.
And speaking of clothing, would you explain what is it pronounced thuu?
Yeah, that's right. It's a Yapi's word for loincloth. They wear these very long bolts of material. They're sort of 28-foot long cotton fabric that's most of the men wear blue, and the women wear lots of different colors, but I too was wearing a thuu. God, that sounds like Dr. Seuss or something.
That's true. Alex wears a thuu.
I too was wearing a blue thuu. But I never did quite learn how to tie it on. It always was sort of sloughed off my hips. Not that I have much in the way of hips. And then I always felt like this, like prom night carnation gone wrong.
Did you ever end up sharing your attributes with the islanders because you had put it together so badly?
Oh, Jeff, that's such a nice way of putting it, my attributes. I don't know if my wife would describe it that way. But the goods were revealed on occasion and really uncomfortably and terribly. Thanks for asking.
Sure. Okay. Well, you mentioned putting it together at one point with a paper clip, which is... What did you call it? The high school dropout cousin to the safety pin?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the paperclip and the safety pin were both invented by the same person, amazingly. But paperclips are not good for holding up loincloths because they bend. So, if you find yourself in a situation, use a safety pin.
Okay, good to know. I want to come back in time just a little bit because there's a couple of asides here that need pursuing. And one of them is your... your adoption of the Cleveland test to relationships, for example. What is the Cleveland test?
So before leaving, I had been dating a woman from Boston, and I was in New York, and we would often meet for the weekend in different places in between, so Vermont or coastal Maine or wherever we could. And I realized, oh my gosh, anybody can get along in those kind of places for the weekend. Maybe we should really put our relationship to the test and go to Cleveland in February and see if it works out. The short answer is we had a lovely weekend, but we broke up amicably but definitively afterwards.
So you didn't pass the Cleveland test on that one?
No, I did not withstand the Cleveland test.
Okay, and then there's another aside in here about how you helped get George W. Bush elected governor of Texas. That requires a little more explanation.
Oh, yeah, this may be my only contribution to world history. I grew up in Texas, and I was working for Governor Ann Richards, her reelection campaign. And one day we got a phone call from somebody saying that they were doing a survey about the candidates' positions on issues. She was running against George W., and the person on the phone said, George W. campaign had filled out the same survey. Were we going to as well? And so I took it to the head of the press office. I was like 18, and I said, hey, I think we should fill out the survey. And the person said, we don't normally fill those out because we can't articulate our nuanced positions on the issues. It's either black or white. And I said, well, I think it's really important. And he said, well, if you think it's so important, go talk to the head of the campaign. And she said the same thing. And she said, but if you really feel strongly about it, go talk to the governor's lawyer, which I did. And he had directed me ultimately to the governor, and I was nervous going to the meeting, and I explained to it. And she had the exact same reaction, but she said, look, if you really want to do it, go ahead and fill it out. And so one of the questions was, do you support an increase in state spending? And we wrote yes, and then on the side wrote, but only for education. Well, it turns out the George W. Bush campaign did not fill out the survey, and then they used our response that the governor supports an increase in spending and sent out 5 million pieces of mail, and we lost by about 3 million votes.
So you provided the oppo material for the Bush campaign to defeat Ann Richards for governor of Texas.
Yeah, that's what I did.
There might have been some other factors in there, you realize.
I'd like to think so, but that was my contribution.
All right, so you had time to think about. I mean, it wasn't just reading and going to the laundromat once you got to Yap. I mean, was there much introspection? Was there sitting by the water and listening to the waves lap up on the beach and just thinking about things?
Jeff, I don't know if you like sat next to the water listening to the waves lap up on the beach, but after about 6 minutes, you start looking for something else. So, at least I did, I was slowly coming to realize that like geography and happiness are maybe not as related as I thought they were. The physical surroundings of where we find ourselves, because we can't all find ourselves in Northern California and Southern Oregon, may not be as conducive to sort of personal fulfillment as maybe I had once thought. And so I had some time to think back about my former life in New York, and one of the things I realized sort of pretty early on was that, you know, you got to stay focused on the things you really care about. You know, it sounds simple, but a lot of us, at least I did, spend a huge amount of time and energy working towards goals that aren't really meaningful, or other people's goals. And it took 10,000 miles and a very remote island for me to help me understand that.
We have an email here from Ariel. She asks, National Geographic did a story about Yap in the 1950s. Did you happen to read their story? If so, how did your experience compare? And then she asks the big questions, where do diapering the baby monkey and falling in love fit in?
I have not read that story, but I would like to. I did bring an anthropology textbook with me about Yap, and I remember showing it to some people, and they were fascinated by it. But it was so cool. It was from the 40s, and it had this black and white picture, and they were able to point to people in the picture and say, "Oh, that's my uncle, or that is my auntie, or whoever it was." And this is what has changed, and so that was pretty neat. I did end up falling in love and adopting a baby monkey. Should we talk about the love first or the monkey first? What do you think, Jeff?
Let's go for the love first, because obviously you can't do the Cleveland test on somebody you met on Pig Island. But this is the odd thing, is you actually met somebody on Pig Island?
It was on a different island called Palau, and which only had was a little bit larger, at 20,000 people, but no stoplights. And they, one day I was coming back to the dock, and there was it was early evening, and there were a group of people who were heading out to go kayaking, and I asked what they were doing. They said they were going to full moon kayak, and I asked if I could join, and they said if we have an extra seat in a kayak, you can. And it turns out there was an extra seat, and it was. I ended up sharing a kayak with a woman I would eventually marry. But for the first 3 hours, it was completely dark. Like, we couldn't see each other's faces. It was like, I guess it was like meeting somebody in a confession booth. Not that I meet a lot of people there, but I would imagine it would be like meeting somebody.
You don't meet many dates in confession booths anyway.
And so, but it was lovely, like, having the beginning of our relationship in such a remote place, because we didn't have friends and family who were sort of asking for updates and wanting to know where things were heading and was it serious. It could evolve at its own pace and its own tempo, and it was really a lucky time that we had together.
So, I mean, were you able to keep seeing Sarah, or were you going back to Pig from Palau, or, I mean, how did that all work out?
No, I ended up moving to Palau, and we lived there together for a little over a year, and then eventually we tried to build a house together, like, more, not really a house, that's an overstatement. It was like a deck with a roof. but the idea, I was kind of done with these books, and I just wanted to do something physical that was meaningful, and what seemed, I couldn't think of anything more essential than the roof over our head. And but we didn't know how to build a house, so we sent an email to all of our friends asking if they wanted to help us build a place, and we couldn't pay them, but we could maybe provide beer. And it turns out people who respond positively to that kind of email have good intentions but not a lot of skills.
Especially once the beer starts flowing, right?
Yeah, exactly. But to answer the emailer's question, so while we were building this house, this guy showed up one day with this baby monkey, and its mother had been killed, and he asked if we wanted the monkey, and we said, well, we'll try to reintroduce it, but we couldn't. We actually emailed experts all around the world, and they said they would be killed as well. And so we ended up having this pet baby monkey, and on this little island, it was an outer island of Palau, actually, where we were building. The store sold pasta, but no pasta sauce, that kind of thing. And so they didn't have baby monkey diapers. And so I would cut up my T-shirts. It turns out you can get 130 diapers out of one T-shirt, so it's like 9 cents a piece.
Do you wear an extra large or something?
But it was a good thing, uh-huh, because that he had these diapers. He would only sleep if sort of nuzzled between us in bed. It was really sweet. They don't make great pets longer term, but as babies, they're quite cute.
Uh-huh. And so what ended up happening to your baby monkey?
Well, we ended up leaving him in the care of a local family, and we go back to visit him on occasion. I like to think he remembers us, but he may not, actually.
There's a great picture in the book of Sarah, who's now your wife, and the baby monkey together, and the facial expressions on both are interesting enough. And you set that up as a caption the photo contest. I wonder if you've gotten many good submissions so far.
I haven't checked recently. Yeah, there are some pictures in the book. In the middle, there's an insert, which is great of my publisher to do. But I couldn't think of a caption for this kind of crazy picture, of Sarah with a monkey. And so I thought about turning it into some sort of contest. We'll see how it goes.
So the whole building of the house thing. I mean, what was the situation where you were able? Did you buy land there, or what happened there?
Right. In most islands in the Pacific, foreigners are not allowed to own land. And the places that you can, namely New Zealand and Hawaii, were prohibitively expensive, but you can lease. And so we went to the matriarchs who run, it's a matriarchal society on this island where we wanted to build, and we asked them for permission. And they said, if you can do it as long as you don't commercialize the property, like build a hotel or something, and you should just look around, we'll find out who owns it, and we'll make an arrangement. So I had this like incredible boyhood dream fulfilled. Like, I was like macheting my way around the coast of Zion looking for the perfect place to build a house. It was thrilling, and we end up finding a little peninsula and building.
How long did it take to put the house together? It looks fairly substantial. I mean, you know, not a lot of walls there, obviously, but you know, you got the but you got good stuff on the bottom and the top.
Yeah, that was one of the lessons I learned, is that houses should have walls. But we had animals coming through all the time, including like 5 foot long monitor lizards that were like these like tropical gangsters. They're so confident. But it took us about 5 months to build a place. The first month we spent just digging holes. Turns out to build, we dug 44 holes in compacted limestone and using crowbars because we didn't have access to electricity. And it was there's easy fun and there's hard fun, and I think that was probably hard fun.
Altogether, how much time did you spend in the Western Pacific?
About a year and a half.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned missing chairs. What were some of the other things you missed over time?
Well, you know, the main thing I grew to miss were friends and family. I know it's expected, but those are personal relationships and connections are really much more meaningful than any sort of beach with palm trees, of course. And being 12 time zones from home started to feel like too many. And eventually we realized that if meaning and what is makes you happy comes not from the place, then you might as well be in a place that's closer to what does make you happy and is meaningful. So we made our way back to the States, but we still go out to visit a lot.
And you live in California now, is that right?
Yeah, that's right, in a little town called Ojai near Santa Barbara.
Oh, yeah, been there. Yeah, right. Sounds like it was quite the adventure for you. I mean, honestly, it's a great memoir. Would you really recommend this path for anybody else?
Well, you know, I guess I can say more generally that if you have a dream, something you really want to do, like don't get all tangled up in your own underpants, asking yourself if it's the right thing, and don't listen to the experts, because when it comes to the big decisions, the big choices, whether it's moving to an island or whatever you want to do, you know, we're all just beginners.
Don't get tangled up in your underpants. That is a great line. Or tangled up in thews, I guess you could say, in the case of the Islanders. A Beginner's Guide to Paradise is the book. Alex Sheshinoff is the author. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
All right, take care.